Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Wasim Ahmed, and I'm a program director and a senior lecturer at James Watt School of Engineering, University of Glasgow. It is an honor to speak today about how innovation in robotics and AI can transform the lives of blind and partially sighted individuals. Assistive technologies, like you have seen Robbie outside, the robo guide we are developing at the University of Glasgow, are already demonstrating immense potential in this area. With advancement in AI, we are developing robots that can function as guide, providing real-time navigation assistance. These technologies are not only improving mobility, but also promoting inclusiveness by making environment more accessible. By pushing the boundaries of innovation, we can create tools that empower individuals, enabling them to navigate the world more easily and safely. So in this session, I will first invite my esteemed guest to introduce themselves. Afterwards, we will discuss how the exponential advancements in AI and robotics are shaping assistive technologies and how these innovations can improve independence and mobility for people with visual impairment and other disability. So please join me to welcome the panel members. So I will start with our first panel member, Lisa Jones. She is from Global VP Starship.
I'm Lisa Johnson. I'm Global Vice President of Public Affairs and Corporate Communications at Starship Technologies. Starship is an autonomous robotics company, and that's why I want to show you a little video. It's got audio description included because it kind of gives a little bit of context to what we do rather than me just trying to describe it. Our autonomous robots are about as wide as a human. They come up just above knee height, and they can fit about 3 bags of shopping in them. And that's what we mostly do in England at the moment, although we operate in Germany, Finland, Estonia, the US, and Sweden as well. Our little robots travel on the pavement, which is why we're in constant dialogue with good folks at RNIB and other organisations, because we understand that that can be difficult to introduce, or at least the perception of it can be difficult to introduce into public spaces. So I think we have a video ready. This is just so you can understand what I'm talking about when I start talking about Starship Robot.
Oops.
Next one. Oh, no. Back again. Okay. You should be able to play that as a YouTube video.
No.
Or not. So what I'll do then is I'll describe the robot. Let's go back. There we go. So our little robot is, like I said, about as wide as a human. It's white. It has 6 wheels, and around the side of each wheel is a yellow reflective trim. The entire lid of the robot lifts up, and inside it is an insulated compartment where you can put your shopping. You lift it through a lip on the back. It's got headlights. It's got rear lights and indicators. At the moment, our little rear lights are set to the Ukrainian flag in support of our friends in the Ukraine. Being an Estonian company, that's important to a lot of folks who work at Starship. We also have a shoulder, just over shoulder, I'm 5'5", and it comes up just over my shoulder. We have a shoulder height flag, and that flag was developed with the RNIB's input. We initially had it, was kind of a pale yellow color, and we were told that's actually not very good for people with low vision. So it's now bright orange with LEDs on it. Its only functional purpose is to ensure that people with low vision can kind of detect the robot. It makes a little bit of noise as it travels. We've deliberately made sure that it's not silent. It makes a little noise as it trundles along so that you can tell when it's coming towards you. But I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about how it behaves as we move into the session, but that is how it looks and moves across the pavement.
Thank you very much, Lisa. So my next panel member is Professor Weya. He's a professor in robotics from North of England Robotics Innovation Centre. Professor Weya.
Yeah, thank you, Lesham. Thank you for inviting me here. It's an honor. My name is Wei Yao. I'm a professor in robotics and I'm from North of England Robotic Innovation Centre based in Manchester. And this center is funded by the European Union to promote the economic development, particularly in Greater Manchester area. And the assistive technology is one of our main research areas for our center. And before we came to the North of England Robotic Innovation Center, I've been a senior lecturer in medical robotics at the Strathclyde University, which is based in Glasgow. And my main research interest is robotic surgery. That includes orthopedic surgery, include robotic devices for fetal surgery, for laparoscopic surgery, for the different surgical and interventional procedures. And my research also interests in developing robotic devices for rehabilitation. For example, our research group have developed a robotic glove for hand rehabilitation, and it has a potential use for assistive device to help stroke patients back to daily life. I would like to share my thoughts in the how we cope with the challenges from our NHS systems, and also how overcoming these challenges to shape the future of robotics in healthcare.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My next panel member is Dr. Mary Ellen Foster. She's a senior lecturer in Human-Robot Interaction, School of Computer Science, University of Glasgow.
Hi. Thanks for having me here. So as he said, my interest is in human-robot interaction. And so while I work with robots, what I really sort of try to work on is not so much building the robots or making the robots move, but sort of once you have a robot, if you want to put it into a space and have it interact with people and have it maybe be a co-worker of the people who already work in that space, really sort of engaging with the other people that are going to also interact with that robot, and sort of make sure that the design you come up with is one that's useful for everybody who's going to be in that space and one that's accepted by the people who might be working with that robot. So for example, I've just finished working on a project together with some Canadian children's hospitals where we developed a robot that would go into the pediatric emergency departments while painful things are being unavoidably done to children. And the robot should sort of help them kind of, you know, I help them to understand and to deal with the painful and distressing things that are being done to them, like inserting an IV into their arm, either by doing breathing exercises or singing songs with them or explaining what's happening. So, and for that, we did very extensive consultation with the parents and caregivers and the children, and also obviously the healthcare professionals in that hospital to make sure that the behavior of the robot was useful and the behavior of the robot didn't get in the way of the other people doing their job. And we've just finished a clinical trial on that where we're still analyzing the results, fingers crossed. I've also been working on robots in the Student Services Center at the University of Glasgow to help students, international students, to get help with bureaucratic processes in their own language. And also I've got a student right now who is working on developing a robot to be deployed in a large church, which is also a tourist attraction, to do sort of visitor exit surveys. And there again, with all of these, the really important thing is to consult with everybody who might interact with a robot to make sure that we're not just saying, here's our robot, we're putting it here, deal with it, but really to make sure that it's useful and usable for everybody who might interact with it. And obviously that has to do with, you know, inclusive design for literally everybody who might interact with the robot. So I can talk more about that.
Absolutely.
In our conversation later.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Last but not the least, Dr. Ola Papola. He's a colleague as well. He's a lecturer in autonomous system and connectivity from James Watt School of Engineering, University of Glasgow.
Hi, everyone. And I'm glad to be here. My research in robotics, it's even different. I look at connected robotics. One of my roles at the university is that I serve as the technical lead of the 5G test bed. We're looking into 5G, 6G communications. if you check the trajectory of development of robotics, you see that most times people put in effort in developing singular robots and then scaling them into having multiple robots. Where my research takes a bit of a trajectory is that we look into connected robots. How could we look at the challenges your singular robots would face, and how would we have robots talk to each other and help them address their challenges? On the philosophical side, what we are looking at is, can we get a form of teacher-student relationship between us as persons and implement that in robot systems? So could we have a more experienced robot teach a less experienced robot how to complete a task, how to perform a task, how to navigate a particular scenario, how to face a bit of difficulty and things like that? The goal for my research is targeting scalability and resilience in robotics. One of the key challenges we have in modern day robots is that you have a robot that is excellent for a particular environment, and when the environment changes, when the conditions changes, when the situation changes, the robot would fail. How could we address this by ensuring that robots could rely on robots to help them perform without failure? In the course of this discussion, I'll be giving my insight as how we could use connectivity in shaping the future of robotics. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ola. Thanks a lot. So I'm very excited to start firing the questions on my panel member. I will start with Lisa. Of course, anyone can chip in, but especially you're already working in the industrial robots, and your robots, we can see it on road, especially doing some real jobs. So what are the key challenges facing the development of robots, and how can they be overcome to ensure usability and inclusiveness for life, for all in the life?
It's a good question. And I think actually a bunch of it comes back to what Mary was saying about human-robot interaction. We're 10 years old at Starship, so we're still a startup, but we're 10 years old because that first 7 years was spent really not doing any deliveries. It was spent building our autonomy and teaching the robots how to be good pedestrians. And that's really, really important, because I think the biggest challenge for us in sort of logistics and how we operate is how you sensitively introduce robots that are basically embodied AI. It's AI that's operating in a public space around people. How you sensitively do that in a way that works for everybody. It's the right thing to do, but obviously as a business as well, we're serving people in the community. We don't want to roll up and go, hey, you're having robots, whether you like it or not, and annoy people, because they're our customers as well as people that we exist alongside. So the big challenge for us has been to remember as a company, first and foremost, that not everybody's seen a robot before. So we've done 10 million miles globally. We've made nearly 8 million deliveries. We talk about robots all the time. But if you roll into Wakefield or Livingston and people have never seen a robot before, how do they know how to interact around it? How do they know to expect from that robot behavior? So I think there's, firstly, you've got to get the autonomy right, and you've got to build it with lived experience at its heart in all aspects of how you operate in the community, be it around children, be it around horses, or be it around people who use canes or guide dogs. So just an example of how we've done that, we've got an accessibility panel. We work with RNIB, Leonard Cheshire. One of the biggest worries people told us was, well, what happens when a robot and a wheelchair are coming towards each other on a narrow pathway? And that's I completely get that. What would you do? We've trained the robot to understand mobility devices. So the robot knows when it sees one. In Finland, which is our biggest operation, we identified 10,000 interactions last year with mobility devices. When the robot understands what something is, the robot can behave differently. So when the robot sees a mobility device, it pings a remote assistant who's sat there waiting to help the robot. And most of the time, actually, the robot doesn't need to do anything because it's a cautious pedestrian, the mobility device is in the distance, and it can just carry on doing what it's doing. But if there is a problem, the robot makes an audible sound. It'll say, hey, I'm a Starship robot. I'm just letting you know that I'm here and a human's coming to help us soon. And because we've built a level of priority around accessibility, the average wait time for a robot to be assisted by a human is 3 seconds. So that's the sort of thing we're talking about when we listen to what people are saying about how the robot should behave. We're currently working on cane recognition that we've been working on with RNIB and also Wakefield District Sight Aid. So I operate in Wakefield in England. And that's really difficult because canes are thin. People use them in different ways. But we're working on it. We need to build up those interactions. And the thing that people have said to us is, well, when the robot sees a cane, the robot should announce its presence. It's great. And that's what we'll do. We'll build that together. And that's how we're sort of co-designing a bunch of our features. But I think in terms of the in how you overcome those barriers. It's good engagement, but it's not just broadcasting to people. It's actually listening and translating those concerns into good communication and understanding. It's taking the time on the outreach, which is more expensive when you're a startup, but it's absolutely the right thing to do. But it's making sure that then internally there's buy-in so that those priorities are translated into engineering and not just nice things that you say you're doing. They actually tangibly change robot behavior. And that'll be a work in progress for years and years to come. I think as colleagues from Google said earlier, you don't do something and stop. You do something and you improve and improve and improve. And that's what we're aiming to do.
Brilliant. While listening to you, I had two questions in mind. The first one is, when we talk about inclusive environment, I've seen in terms of the infrastructure, we still have payments and some other accessibility problem. How did you deal with it in terms of the local services or local authorities? And the second question is, in terms of development during your development time, how did you involve the end user into your design or in terms of adoptability?
So in terms of adoptability, we have working groups. So we have groups of people who come together to test out the robot behavior, almost like sort of test groups, basically, of people who come together and let the robot behave and then give our feedback about how the robot is behaving and where the improvements should be made in terms of how that, because really the hardware is one thing, right? The hardware is relatively easy to get right. The autonomy and the robot behavior is a thing that's more difficult. And even if the robot behaves perfectly, if you've not done the engagement work, the humans still behave how humans want to behave, right? So the robot can behave exactly how you expect it to. It doesn't mean humans will. So trying to communicate with humans how the robot will behave is quite important. So, for example, we get traffic jams sometimes when we first launch because people wait at zebra crossings in their cars for the robot to cross, but the robot can see a car, so the robot's not going to move. And it's that sort of human behavior aspect that we need to get through. In terms of infrastructure, the robots have got pretty good. So we operate in inner city Tallinn and Helsinki. We operate on industrial sites, moving things around big campuses in Germany. So the robots understand the world very, very well. I think we've probably got some aligned concerns around pavement parking and things like that. But ultimately, the robot is programmed to be a cautious pedestrian. It'll just stop and wait if it's stuck. It can climb up and down curbs. It can't do stairs. Mm. So it can navigate pretty much everything a human can navigate, really. But yeah, I think in terms of actually working with local authorities, that is the important bit, because we never operate where people don't think we should. So we work hand in hand with local authorities, and our autonomy is bounded. And by bounded autonomy, we mean that we pre-map everywhere we go. We risk assess it. We'll look at where the robot should cross. It will only cross in the places that we tell it should cross. If we think a pavement's too narrow or there are continual problems that people keep raising with us, we'll just say, hey, robot, that road no longer exists. You can't go down there. So the robot is only autonomous within the confines that we set for it. And that also helps us to be able to operate more sensitively in the areas that we're in. And so that could be people saying to us, we don't like you going through this park because you're disturbing the wildlife, which happened to us in one place. It could be you're crossing too close to a roundabout and that's a little bit problematic. Can you stop? Or it could be this pavement's too narrow and people with a walking frame are struggling when they meet your robot, which has also happened in Leeds, actually. And so that bounded autonomy allows us to also be in real time sensitive to people and their communities and operate in a better way.
Great. Thank you very much. I will come back to you. I have another question related to later question. I will come back. But feeding into your answers, next question to Professor Yeo. In terms of what role does AI play in improving the real world functionality, because you have worked in a very challenging environment or very sensitive environment like NHS robots. So what do you think in terms of real-world functionality of assistive robots, and how far are we from having robots that can provide assistance in the daily life in real time?
Thank you for these questions. It's a really good question. The AI technology recently bring a huge impact to robotics and assistive technology. To be honest, we don't even know how the AI works, particularly how it's connected to robotics, because AI at the moment is focused on LLM, the large language model, which they can collect a huge number of data from internet, which is a virtual world. But for robotics and assistive technology, we are dealing with the data from real physical world. So you can analysis a large scale of data from internet and try to find some relationship between the pattern of the data. But if you want to control a real robot and allow the robot understanding the real physical world, for my opinion, it still has a very long distance. So because first of all, you need to explore, you need to investigate the technology that you can sense and collect and measure those data from this physical world. And you must use different modality of sensors. You should collect like visual data. You should collect like tactile sensing. You should collect many different modality data in order to understand the real physical world. And then you have to use this limited data rather than the huge number of data from internet to train, to use the machine learning to train your robots, which is bring a great limitation with the limit of the data you can collect it. And again, you have to analyze this different modality of this sensing data. And then you have to train your robot, and then you control your robot interactive with this physical world. Sometimes it's very complicated with very complicated environments. To achieve to assistive robot that can help people to adaptable to the different environment and return to the daily life, you have to develop many different technologies in order to achieve to this technology.
Can I finish?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So I think part of what the issue is that so modern AI is obviously modern 2025 AI is large language models and machine learning. AI obviously goes back to like the 1960s, and the sort of AI, so artificial intelligence is a thing people have been working on since in the 60s, 70s, and there's kind of old-fashioned AI techniques that don't use machine learning, don't use a lot of data, that do sort of more defining rules or defining sort of behaviors at a more sort of hand-coded level. And in terms of trying to get a robot into the real world right now, I think trying to do something a little bit, maybe the cutting edge of AI things isn't quite ready to deal with sort of a dynamic real-world decision-making in that way. You might need to sort of go back to older types of AI decision making, where there's more of a human authoring, in this situation do this, in this situation do this, or a little bit more like more of that kind of AI. Because I think what you're saying is that modern machine learning, in terms of something that's not in the world inside a computer, but in the actual real world, might not actually behave properly. You might need to have a bit more control over it. So I don't know how Starship works. Do you have is it machine learning or kind of good old-fashioned AI or kind of a mixture?
It's neural networks and machine learning that come together. But it's 99% autonomous. It crosses roads autonomously.
Okay.
But we're constantly building it. So for example, 99% autonomous with a human backup function on assistance, not operation if it's needed. Mm-hmm. But operating in Finland, last year we realized the robots don't know snow. Like, they know a bit of snow, but they don't know Finnish snow and Lapland snow. And if you've learned the entire world and you understand it perfectly, and then all of a sudden it's covered in white snow and it changes how things reflect, mm-hmm. and you don't know if the thing that you're going up against is a snowbank or a postbox that's covered in snow. And that has come together with hardware. So it's got a little snow mode where it wiggles its bum to try and get unstuck if it gets stuck in snow. But that's an example of it developing over time and learning more through the autonomy. So we've got 2,000 robots, and kind of one of our fundamental values at Starship is we learn with every journey. That goes for the employees, but it goes for the robots. So when you've got 2,000 robots in operation, each one of them every day is learning and sending information around the fleet that they're learning. There's a constant evolution of the behavior. And that's why it took us so long to get to the level of autonomy and the number of deliveries. You would kind of see the deliveries of Starship for the first 7 years as a very shallow line, creeping. And then you get to sort of 7-8 years in, the line suddenly shoots up. We start doing 1 million deliveries. And once you've got to 1 million deliveries, getting to 4 million deliveries is much, much quicker. And that's because it's learning constantly and building its capability to operate. And then it makes decisions quicker. Mm. So it knows when it can go faster, when it can go slower. It learns what humans are when they're laid down, not just when they're stood up. So in a park, it doesn't run over people having picnics, for example.
Great. I think we are looking at two aspects of it. One is trying to design and build a very specialized kind of robot like Starship, which can do one kind of job in a very, very best way. But on the other hand, we are looking at general purpose robots, which can be used at household, which will be capable of doing several jobs, like how human assistants can do it. And as Professor Yao said, we need a lot of data and expertise, a lot of sensors, and we need to deal, Dr. Mary said, different kind of scenario in a safe environment. And collecting these data from a lot of sensors, a lot of scenario, then it brings us to my next question to Mary. How can we address ethical concerns around the data privacy, safety, and decision-making autonomy in the context of robotics design for personal assistance in this case? It's a big stake in this case.
So that's obviously something in the sort of modern world of AI where a lot of, you know, the most powerful AI things are run by very, very large companies, and the way that they're able to do such smart things is it's happening on their servers in a different place. So if you want to have, you know, absolutely the most powerful reasoning models, you're going to have to use, you know, send your data to somebody else and they will process it for you and send it back. And that's obviously a huge problem. So, and it's a thing that people are grappling with in the field right now is, yeah, there's a trade-off basically if you're trying to build something between can you do everything locally or as I'm sure probably happens in Starship, in kind of your own local server, like the learning presumably all happens within your company's ecosystem.
Yeah.
So it's not happening on board on the robot. That would probably be, you know, you couldn't do a lot of reasoning with the hardware you could fit onto a single robot. But if it's kind of, it's honestly a question in the field right now, and it's not one that people have a really good answer to. I mean, because if you want to do the absolute most amazing reasoning, the most amazing decision making, you've got to send your stuff to big giant companies in a different country. And if that's to do with your own personal data, especially if we're talking about as this question is specifically talking about, like personal assistance robots, this might be a robot that's in your home.
Exactly.
which is helping you with sort of personal care tasks, and you know if the microphone is always on, it hears every conversation you have with your family. It might sort of know if you're having a good day or a bad day, and so, I mean, this is an area where I know different countries are sort of trying to come up with kind of legislation and guidelines and things like what's allowed. I think even there's a thing. I think sometime like later this month, Amazon is changing I would have to read the news stories completely, but there's something to do with Amazon Alexa devices are now sort of going to send everything. There's some privacy setting changing on Amazon Alexa devices, which is doing the sort of thing I'm talking about, that more of your data might be going to Amazon servers than it was before. And this is, you know, I'm not really answering the question. I'm just sort of saying it's a bit sad. I'm not sort of saying how can we address it. It's just a thing that you need to keep in mind when you're building one of these things. Is it's always a trade-off between how much can we do with the power that's available to us locally, ourselves, or within the company, versus how much are we willing to sacrifice if we, you know, of privacy, of your own personal data. If you can do something really amazing with it, but you've got to upload it to Amazon servers in the US, it's a trade-off. It's a question. I don't know. It's an active thing in the field.
In terms of some of the examples you earlier gave us, in terms of your robots working with the kids.
Oh, in the hospital, that was completely local. It was in a hospital. We couldn't even access the internet at all.
Okay. So the audio or the video data or any images you are collecting
didn't even leave the robots.
Robots, okay. And even though they don't leave it, do you save them on your local robot or they are just?
We save it for debugging purposes, but literally nobody but the developers ever sees it. So that was one where, I mean, there were technical constraints as well, because we were deploying it in an emergency department in a hospital where the internet situation is, we couldn't have considered cloud things because it would never have worked. But for example, the thing in the student services center at the university that worked, I think it used cloud-based speech recognition, but it did the reasoning locally. But that was kind of a prototype. If we were building that for real, we would have to think about these things some more. If people are asking sensitive questions, you maybe don't want to keep track of the fact that people are asking for help with not just council tax, but some sort of, you know, domestic situation that they might want help with. They might not want that information sent into the cloud. So, yeah.
Yeah. Just to buttress what Amir has been saying, there's a bit of research trajectory in that regard. Looking at how we can optimize the use of robots locally without sending data outside of the local reasoning of the robots. And this happens in two ways. One is that we could improve the data management systems, and we could also improve the reasoning of the robots. So instead of using the expert machines, the high computing nodes or high GPU servers to improve the, to manage our data or to improve or work on the reasoning of the robots, we only use that to it updates the robot's weights and the robot's intelligence. So the reasoning is done locally. Your data is not transferred outside. Your data happens locally. Your data is used locally, but then the reasoning model is used, is downloaded from a much expert reasoning model on the cloud or somewhere on the server farm. So by using such strategies, we could, in essence, ensure privacy to some aspects. One of these models is what we call federated learning, where we don't work with data, we only work with intelligence on the robots. The other one that we are looking at recently talks about mobile edge computing. So mobile edge computing creates an hierarchical way of processing your data. So instead of having the two-layer structure where you have your robot and then you have your intelligent cloud server farms, you have this hierarchy of edge computing nodes. And across the hierarchy, data is abstracted. So let's say you have your data from your mobile phone gets to your Alexa device. And the Alexa node, that's stage one. A bit of reasoning is done there. A bit of encapsulation is done there. A bit of federated learning is done there. That takes it to level two. Level two could be your Wi-Fi router. Your Wi-Fi router will have a bit of intelligence to also filter the data. Then that goes to level three. Your level three on the 5G, 6G side will happen at your base station. So at your base station, which is your local cell, there's a bit of federated learning going there, privacy preservation going on there. So you have this hierarchy of data preservation across the line. So when the data gets to the server farms, it's useless almost to know what exactly you're talking about. If somebody sniffs at the cell tower, the person will really not get the full picture. If they go down, they will sniff your Wi-Fi access points, they won't get the full picture. So by breaking your data, encapsulating federated learning, mobile edge computing, we ensure that your data's privacy is preserved. However, there's still lots of work to be done, as Mary said, because this is just the beginning of it.
Yeah, but that'll be a good solution.
Good solution, but it needs a revamp of our infrastructure, all the infrastructure in terms of connectivity. And University of Glasgow and many other partners are working on that. So when we were working on Robbie, the RoboGuide, you have seen it, and many others I've spoken to, we get one of the questions quite often. Will it replace guide dog? Or generally, whenever we talk about any robots, people said, oh, they're going to take human jobs, or will they replace human? So my next question is a bit relevant to Dr. Ola, related to that. It says, what impact might future advancement in robotics have on traditional services for individuals with a disability, especially, such as guide dog or human carer? And how can we ensure a balance between technology and a human touch here?
There is the balance between technology and human touch. We cannot design robots for human touch, at least not yet. Even if we design with a silicone that have literally warm fingers, they would not have the human intelligence, the empathy, the emotional intelligence to deal with people. So although there is a great progress in the area of emotional robots or robot emotions, however, the focus for us is improving expert systems in the sense that we will dedicate robot tasks to robots and human tasks to humans. For instance, carers, instead of currently looking after their health, their well-being, the physical location or the physical positioning of the person they are caring for, carers could focus more on providing compassionate assistance, emotional assistance, having conversations with this person. And then we develop expert robots to look into the things like assisted living, looking into the things like taking care of their homes, taking care of their dishes, taking care of their clothes. So by separating this task, the robot task, robots will build expertise on the robot task. And then for the human parts, the conversations, the human touch, the emotional parts, I think it's best we leave that for now with the humans.
I think the empathy part is very important. Either we can integrate that some part of it, not fully, as you said, you trained your robots to try to recognize the wheelchair user. And so this part, only one aspect of that empathy or care. Same thing is for the...
Oh, they're very polite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, please. Thank you.
Good. Excellent. But of course, we are far away from such kind of empathy or emotional recognition in terms of how we can have that kind of emotional connection between the people. So we might have a little time to take one or two questions. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, great. So we have a microphone somewhere. A gentleman here, and the second row here. And then the next microphone at the back there, if possible. So we'll take at least this question.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you very much for such illustrious presentation. It's kind of leaves you a little bit dizzy. To Lisa, I do mobility. I teach mobility. And I go to a lot of countries. Outside the expectations here of you stop at traffic light, then it turns green, then you cross, then somebody. There's more or less. What do you expect? If you go to India, go to, Kenya, Uganda, there isn't any of those expectations. I mean, I can see your robot not moving because there's tuk-tuk, everything is moving simultaneously at a very, very fast speed. How is it going to maybe address those things where it's a constant flow, day and night. And I can tell you, if you go to Kampala in the morning with those tuk-tuks, it's not going to move anyway. Thank you very much.
Yeah, please.
It's a really good question. And for the same reason, Copenhagen gives me nightmares as well with the bicycles. And I think that's for us to be like, use technology where you can do good and where it will work well. So, for example, we do city centres, but we don't do city centres where there's really, really heavy footfall. The reason is the robot is so cautious that it will constantly stop and no one will ever get their shopping because it's programmed to be cautious. Now, if you wanted, you could say to the robot, be less cautious, just go. We're not going to do that because that's not how we've sort of, the ethos of how we work as a company. But there will be solutions to the environments that you're talking about. But it also comes back to that question of let humans do the things that humans are good at and let robots do the things that robots are good at. So maybe it isn't right now ready for Kampala. We've not tried it though, in all honesty. And we have to be honest about when we're teaching the robots have been taught on very Western road systems and very Western ways of people behaving. And that's potentially something as we expand to different markets, the robots will have to do some more learning to figure out new things.
Yeah. So I can just, this is something that a lot of the time is when we start, I do a lot of this with robots going into other people's workspaces. And quite a lot of the time, the initial reaction we have is, oh my God, the robot's going to steal our jobs. It's like, you haven't seen the robot. It's not going to steal your job. Don't worry. And but I mean, in terms of what modern robots are actually capable of is a lot less than what people imagine from like science fiction. So you kind of have to, I mean, it'd be nice to eventually build C-3PO. We're not there yet. Yes. And you sort of need to reassure people that, no, this is not going to steal anybody's job. The most it's going to do is maybe take, you know, it can do some of the repetitive parts of your job, which are probably not the parts that you enjoy doing anyway. And it lets you concentrate on the sort of more places where human creativity is going to go. But I've repeatedly had that when approaching a new workplace, a new public space to put a robot into people's initial reaction before they saw it was, oh God, it's going to steal all our jobs. No. And we're like, no, let me show you the robot. Trust me, it's not going to happen. So, yeah.
But just very, very quickly on that, because I'm conscious of time, but we get that a lot, obviously. There are delivery drivers and there are riders who do deliveries. But that's a growing need. People want small amounts of goods and they want it quickly. And particularly if we're in a suburban area, how is it ethical and sustainable for a human to travel 45 minutes to deliver your tenner's worth of shopping? That's kind of where we come in. We're meeting a growing need in the market to be able to ethically and sustainably do that little bit of last mile that actually isn't profitable for humans to do.
True. That's very true. Can we take the second question from the back, please?
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. My question particularly is around, I mean, we have different companies who are building robots now. Looking at the fact that there's a bit of, for example, a talkback in an Android operating system, and regardless of who is producing that Android operating system, be it Samsung or another or Google Pixel, there is a talkback built into it. Is there any kind of thinking around building some accessibility features into the operating systems of many of those robots, and how can we start thinking around this level of universal design? Thank you.
Very technically detailed question in terms of the operating system built up.
I think when you talk about accessibility features, I want to know, I think you might be talking about from the end user's perspective, not from the developer's perspective. So if it's at the end user's perspective, we talk about the UI and the UX design, talk about the usability of the robot. And I think in most cases, we develop that based on by working with people who have the challenges or the some needs that we'll be using the robot. So we consider our users as part of our development cycle. So by doing that, we basically cover that. But if you go down to the core operating system from the developer's perspective, yes, I think there are some more things to be done on including accessibility features, but not just on the operating system, but the platform, the IDEs for using that developers would use and things like that. That's where we need the features. But from the user's perspective, that will be on the UI UX side, and I think that's covered in the developmental cycle now.
Yeah, right. I think just engaging with everybody who might, any stakeholders at any level, just making sure you engage with them throughout the whole process is the way to make sure you haven't forgotten something that somebody might need, just in general.
Grace, sorry for the, I'm just mindful of the time. Can we stop here if you don't mind? And we can continue. Our panel members will be around. So if you have any further question, maybe you can catch one of them or all of them after the conference.